Hello and welcome to the iCandy Duo podcast. I'm your host, Naomi Williams. This podcast is brought to you by iCandy World, makers of beautifully British pushchairs for parents across the globe. For our final show of the season, we're delighted to be joined on the iCandy Duo podcast by chartered clinical child psychologist, Dr. Ben Weiner. With a holistic approach to each and every client, he supports children, families and adults with physiological and neurophysiological difficulties. We caught up with Dr. Ben to talk about the easing of lockdown restrictions and the complicated emotions this may cause for many families, especially as children who start attending school again. Through his experience and expertise, we gain a deeper understanding of emotional responses and behaviour within children and the things parents can keep in mind when it comes to navigating these feelings. Hello, Dr. Ben. It's so lovely to have you on the iCandy Duo podcast. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. I'm very good. I'm very good. It's so lovely to have you. This is our season finale. So it's really nice to actually kind of almost wrap up, in a way, our kind of period in lockdown with yourself as we talk about kind of the effects and things that, you know, how we're all feeling. Now lockdown is easing and we go back to this kind of, I don't know if you can even say normal, this sort of normality, but this kind of back to how it was kind of thing. So it's really lovely to have you on the show to kind of finish season one off. You're a chartered clinical psychologist. I mean, what does a working life for you look like, and sort of what would you know, like a family's experience coming to visit your practice look like?
So I think being a clinical psychologist, so an area that I'm very, very passionate about. And I think one of the reasons that I went into clinical psychology is we get to be the jack of all trades. So we know little about a lot. And so that's something that I really enjoy about my job. So I think one of the fallacies is that clinical psychologists are there to offer therapy, which is a massive part of my day and my career, but also there's lots more to it. So in terms of me on a personal level, I offer supervision to a variety of different clinicians. Some are psychologists, some are counselors from different backgrounds. I work in the family court as an expert witness, thinking about where young people may be placed and thinking about their welfare in their current situation. And I also run a practice for young people, their families and adults who are presenting with some level of distress. So that, I think, falls into the latter part of your question, where it's what would the process be in terms of if they did come into the clinic? So for me, I offer a screening conversation with everyone. I think the first thing is, are we the right people? I think that's always got to be a conversation. Is there that immediate click, especially in the private sector, where you can have that autonomy to make that decision? But then we have an initial assessment where we kind of think who wants what and for whom. So we have a think together with the family or with the individual around what's the difficulty in your life and what would you like to be different? So we get quite goal orientated quite fast, so that we make sure we think about what an ending looks like. I forever quote a 15-year-old I once worked with. She has no idea how famous she is. Hopefully this makes her more famous. But she asked me, why are you so desperate to get the sack? And I just thought that was a really beautiful way to summarize some of my job, is actually the quicker people leave the clinic, the quicker they feel able to get back to their lives, the better we've done as a clinic. So that's something I feel really strongly about, that therapy is a bit of a weird space. It's not something we want people to be in for really long periods of time, but also we don't want to push people out the door faster than they're ready to go. So it's that fine balance between the two.
And I suppose it's actually building that initial relationship when you have that first consultation as well, because I suppose in a way I'm kind of used to, you know, really have like a family doctor. You there's a sense that maybe you don't have like so much choice, but it's kind of actually with this style of practice, you'd kind of want to make sure, like when you talk about your feelings to certain friends and maybe not others. I suppose it's kind of like a sort of similar thing of building that initial kind of relationship.
Yeah. So, I mean, something that I feel very strongly about is that before I get into any conversations about why someone might come to see me, what might be going on in their lives, psychologists like to use fancy words. It makes us sound clever, but we go along the line of problem-free talk, which, to put more simplistically, is, you know, I'm not going to get to know you. I'm not going to leave today's meeting thinking I know you really well, but give me a sense of who you are, what you like to do before we talk about some things that might be a bit harder. We know from lots of research, one of the biggest predictors of success in therapy is how well you get on with your therapist. So it's not how qualified they are, how much you respect them. It's do you have that relationship? So that first bit is so important before you get on to where we're going next.
Because I mean, like you said, you support children, you know, families as a whole and adults. And there's like a huge range of therapies that you can cater for. Actually, you draw on sort of CBT, which I'm relatively familiar with, but there's systemic family, narrative, solution focused, compassion, acceptance and commitment therapies, which are kind of, you know, lovely words.
I'm not even reading the website.
Yeah, no. I have, and we will be testing you on this. But like, what are those kind of key differences? And I suppose specifically kind of the differences between children and adults and those approaches.
So one of the unique things about clinical psychology training is our focus on what's called formulation, which again is a very fancy word. What the metaphor I often use is, if you imagine you're cooking up a dinner, there's loads and loads of ingredients. So if you think about the recipe being whatever is brought someone into clinic, we'll then think about what the different ingredients in that recipe are. So if someone's feeling very, very low in mood, we'd think about what's contributing towards that, whether it's biological, psychological, social, or anything else. And then we'll think about, well, what can we address in this setting based on what we've just discussed? So, you know, I often reference different evidence-based psychological therapies because there are different approaches to working with different people. And I think the key bit is thinking about who you're sat with. So, you know, you and I today, we might go down a cognitive behavioral therapy approach, but the next person I speak to might really benefit from a narrative therapy approach. And as long as there's evidence behind whatever intervention we're going to go down, it's about, who are you and what would work for you and your personality and your circumstance and your culture? So it's not one size fits all. It's how do we tailor the research, the evidence to the person we're with? So drawing on the other part of your question, I think particularly when we work with young people, we inevitably think a bit more about the system. If you work with a 10-year-old, you can't expect a 10-year-old to make all the changes in their life that might change their mood or affect how they're getting on at school. You might need the teacher, the parents, the grandparents, anybody in the system to support the child to make those changes, or even make changes around the child that will create changes for the child. So there's much more of a systems approach when we work with young people, because we've got more investment. And the turn of phrase I'll often use is about who's part of the solution. So who can help that individual to make the changes in their lives or around their lives?
That's really interesting, because I know from like a previous conversation we had as well, are there like actually sort of neurological differences as well? And would that obviously affect what kind of therapy and practice you use?
I think it ties in with how we work with different people. So everybody has different levels of cognitive ability. Our brains are all wired different. But you and I having this conversation are two adults whose brains are hopefully relatively well developed and relatively set in their ways. There's always the flexibility in our brains, but we've gone past puberty, we're in our adulthood, and so there's less flexibility. When we work with young people, there's loads of flexibility. So often we think about how the system can influence that child's flexibility in their brain. So I remember when we spoke before recording today, we were talking about the upstairs, downstairs brain for children, and how as the adult around the young person, we might try and connect the two parts of the brain together without getting the child to do anything, by modeling, by showing, by caring, looking after that young person. So the upstairs brain is about the part of the brain that does the processing, making sense of things. And the downstairs part of the brain is the instinct. It's the fight flight concept. It's the, oh my gosh, I can't believe you haven't given me dinner. I'm starving. I'm screaming. I'm shouting. And the upstairs brain is thinking, I don't care. I'm hungry. Whereas as we get older, we might be able to process, maybe shouting won't get dinner on the table. Maybe it won't hurry up. So when working with families and young people, we might think with the adults about how they can connect two systems, because the child's not cognitively able to do that. If I explain that, so it makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I just think that's so fascinating, because I had no idea. You just think the brain is the brain, and that it's you know, it's almost like you're born with the same abilities in some way, like from when you're a child, and you almost sort of just, I don't know, maybe become more aware of different facets by experience, not because your brain hasn't quite necessarily put those pieces together. I guess it's kind of like saying the same thing as what you just said, but it's actually through those experiences and the sort of system around it. Because actually, especially with, you know, obviously, like I said, we're coming out of our hopefully final lockdown, and you know, the lives of families have dramatically changed over the last year, to the point where we almost call it normal, like the being at home is normal now. But like, you know, and it's affected adults and obviously children in various different ways. So we're kind of dealing with the fact that we've had to get used to a sense of isolation, and like social distancing, and just generally being apart from family and friends. But then also a lot of people might be dealing with grief over this period as well. From the change of environments to dealing with, you know, with the death of someone they've been close to, are there differences in how you've seen children and adults kind of respond to that?
I think it depends kind of on the age of the child. Because I think if we're talking about very little ones, you know, you've got newborns who have been born during the pandemic, during lockdown, they've never had contact with a grandparent, they've never been to a baby group. They are very, very close to mum, dad, whoever the caregiver might be. But no separation from them, no exploration of the world in what might be, in inverted commas, a typically developing situation. That would be a very different situation for that child compared to a secondary school child, who, if we're going back to the cognitive development idea, their brains are pretty well developed. They've got a pretty good sense of what's going on in the world, and therefore they might cognitively be able to process and understand a bit more, and therefore it might be a bit more of a shock to the system. I think the key bit for me is about communication. How able is a young person to communicate their level of distress, discomfort, adjustment, whatever it might be, to this situation compared to an adult? Now, I don't think we should assume that adults can do that better, because lots of adults can't, and that's so variable, and there's no right or wrong with that.
Do you think there are any practice? I mean, especially because, I mean, a lot of our listeners will have children that are potentially quite young, so they might be kind of, like you say, about sort of, you know, children born into lockdown, or, you know, or toddlers that haven't, you know, necessarily seen grandparents, or are just going back to nursery, and they're kind of, you know, it's that kind of dramatic change of environment. And maybe some parents are noticing sort of like nuances in behaviour, or you know, potentially sort of maybe they're seeing sort of signs of maybe anxiety about going back to school, or just kind of even from small shifts that a parent can notice to maybe even something that's quite dramatic, like a real kind of change in sort of personality, I guess. Is there any practices that you think could help, you know, a parent identify these things, but also, you know, maybe help alleviate some of that stress for children? Because, you know, they haven't long been back out, you know, like I say, in school, in nurseries and things. Is there any kind of small things that they could do to help, like I say, yeah, alleviate that stress?
I mean, I think a phrase that I unapologetically have repeated over and over again over the last year is humans' reactions at the moment, but young people specifically, we're having normal reactions to abnormal events. So whether that's to a parent or a very young child, whoever that might be, nobody's ever lived like this. You know, we've had wars, we've had evacuations. To the best of my knowledge, and I don't want to be quoted on this because I'm sure they're all academics that will come and correct me, but certainly to the best of my knowledge, we haven't had a situation where young people have had sudden ruptures in their education, sudden adjustments in their social situations, suddenly taken away from different childcare facilities. So any reaction is not necessarily pathological, but rather better understood in the context of the madness of the world right now. So things like separation anxiety, I was talking earlier around never leaving mum or dad or any caregiver for that matter, to suddenly going to nursery, we would anticipate that that child is going to take much longer to settle into nursery. And that rather than saying there's a problem, we should think about how do we facilitate that transition? How do we support it? And how do we make the right changes? So maybe the settling in period needs to be longer. Maybe when they're in the nursery setting, they need someone nearby for a longer period of time, or a key worker that, you know, I don't want to tell nurseries how to run themselves. They're much more equipped than I am. But how do we make the relevant adjustments for those young people? Because they didn't choose these circumstances. One of the models that I think is really helpful is kind of for parents is to think about what's called the iceberg model. So the tip of the iceberg might be a tantrum. It might be not sleeping. It might be bedwetting. It might be crying as you enter nursery. What I'd be saying, similar to the example I gave before about the recipe and the ingredients, is what's under that iceberg? Is it isolation? Is it not seeing people? Is it having no physical interaction with other people? Is it having a bereavement? Is it mum and dad aren't okay? The caregiver isn't okay. So, you know, rule number one, if a parent isn't okay, then they're going to struggle to make sure their child's okay. So actually the parental mental health might be the thing that needs addressing, not the separation anxiety, because otherwise we're just putting sticky plasters on things without addressing the core issue. I'm a firm believer that parents and caregivers know their children better than anyone else. So I don't sit here today thinking this is what you should look out for. Parents and caregivers are going to know what is normal in inverted commas for their child and when things are beginning to look a bit different. And I think if you're worried, speak to someone. If it was your physical health, you'd go and speak to someone. So if it's your mental health, why wouldn't you?
Yeah, I think it's important actually what you just touched on as well, because, you know, obviously adults, you know, all of us have had an incredibly difficult year. And I can imagine if you've got young children, you know, a lot of people might have gone on furlough, have been made redundant, you know, or that you're working from home and you're just somehow having to juggle, you know, your normal day-to-day working life with having small children that want and need your attention. So it must, you know, that you can't kind of, yeah, sort of, you know, brush it off and think that most adults out there are going to be absolutely fine as well. But it's an interesting way where it's kind of, you know, the conversation doesn't just stop with what the child's behavior looks like. Mm-hmm. It's actually, like you say, with the iceberg effect, actually, maybe let's see how mum or dad is doing, or the, you know, the primary caregiver, and see if any of that is creating that environment for the child to behaving in that way. I mean, for there might be some parents as well listening that, you know, they're seeing this and they kind of want to reach out and maybe start a little bit of a conversation with their kids, you know, and just try and bridge a gap, at least to try and understand if there been any behavior changes. Talking to kids is an absolute maze in itself. I have like nieces and nephews, and, you know, unless it's sort of evolved around some, you know, some sort of point of negotiation where they will win a sweet or something out of it, sometimes it can be quite tricky, especially if they are young as well. Is there any kind of advice that you'd give about kind of, even if it's just, you know, moving to a calmer environment, or, you know, especially if small children are still at home and, you know, because parents are still predominantly working from home at the moment as well. Is there any kind of maybe tips or anything that you would, you know, maybe advise just as a starting point that might help parents?
I think it's an area I could go off on one, so I'm going to try not to. I'm happy to send you through a link afterwards. So the British Psychological Society have published some great stuff during COVID. And part of the British Psychological Society is a faculty for children and young people. And they've produced some great small handouts that I can share the link with you afterwards about how do you talk to children about COVID, about feelings during COVID. So rather than going totally off on one, I'll just signpost the listeners to that if they're interested. I think for me, parents and caregivers will know their children best. So I wouldn't say to someone, this is how you address it. This is where to go about. I think it's knowing your child. Is it best to do it while they're playing? Is it best to pull them aside and go somewhere quiet, go for a walk, have special time, whatever that might be? I think one of the key messages that I feel quite strongly about is actually parents' and caregivers' responsibilities in modelling, in saying, but daddy's a bit stressed today because he's had to work and he hasn't been the best he could have been, and I'm sorry for that, but it's going to be okay. And I think it's that both and of naming your feelings communicates to a child that we can talk about any feeling, and telling them that it's going to be okay and giving them that assurance is containing. Mm. Now, the key bit within that is authenticity, because if you don't actually think it's going to be okay and you say that, a young person's probably going to pick that up on some nonverbal cue. And so if you can't say it authentically, I think I'd be reticent and not jump straight in. But I think that actually naming your own feelings is a really big part of modeling that to children, so that they can then approach you later, maybe not this age, depending what age they are, it might be later in their life, but you're beginning to set that example for them.
I suppose that's important, actually, establishing the normality of that, you know, and actually, you know, making emotions and recognizing them and identifying them and addressing them as a normal kind of conversation. It isn't like a dramatic, right, we need to talk, you know, it's actually a part of everyday conversation.
I think the other thing to add to it, and I'm very conscious of it as I'm talking, is, you know, I have a set of training, but we're all human beings, right? So I'm a father. Believe me, there are days where I haven't done that successfully. And I think that's really important to communicate that it's not, oh, if you just do this, it'll all be okay. You know, we're all going to have off days. We're all going to be a bit more short-fused, snappy, not do it the way we want to do it. And I think the key bit there is about the concept of being a good enough parent. You're going to make mistakes. That's being a parent. I think as a parent and a clinical psychologist, it's about, oh, I didn't handle that well. What do I need to do next time? Because that situation will probably come back up again, whether it's in COVID or not. And I think that's really important for listeners. It's not try this out and it'll all be fine. It's rather keep an eye on it. Notice how you're doing.
I suppose actually, especially with parents that are listening to this, they probably are coming in with the energy of, you know, I must have failed somehow, like my child's really upset or this is happening, you know, almost like make me a better parent. But actually, it's not about that at all. It's because we're all trying our best and that's kind of the best you can be.
And I think, you know, the inner geek in me comes out with more research of actually the research is all about good enough parenting. Strive for perfectionism, wonderful, but if that debilitates you, then you can't be good at it. Whereas actually, if you can own, I want to be the perfect parent and I'm never going to achieve it, then maybe you're listening to this podcast seeking advice, but it's not that you're going to go away and be able to do it all the time. It's kind of, there's some ideas for me to continue to think about and try out and see how consistent I can be.
And actually, yeah, like you said earlier, actually, maybe it's stepping away from that worry. Because like you say, you know your kids better than anybody. So actually, stop beating yourself up. Take a minute. Look at the situation, and like you say, is the best time to talk to them when they're in the middle of playing or just after dinner, or you know you will know the right times. You just need to sort of listen to yourself and have faith in the fact that you are doing a good job and you know your kids better than anyone.
I think it's also thinking about communicating kids. We're talking about specifically language, but actually for younger kids that might be that helpful, or kids with neurodevelopmental difficulties. They might not have the language. So I think it's also thinking about other ways to communicate with young people, which might be drawing, it might be colour coding, like what mood are you in today? How are you feeling? I'm a green, I'm a red. It might be a scale system, you know, zero's not good and 10's perfect. Where are you at? I think it's thinking about being quite creative with children and how we can get that information. You know, you and I are having a dialogue here, and we might have a assumed shared understanding of emotional language. But that's an assumption in itself that you and I actually never really tested out, which is we should be even more cautious of when we're talking with children, because they might not have that language. And if they don't have it at home and it's happening at school or vice versa, we just need to be creative about how we might communicate that.
That's so true, actually. I'm just thinking, actually, even in my day-to-day life at work, where it's really interesting, actually, when you're kind of even briefing in people on a project or something, some people will be more receptive to go, oh yeah, just send me over a document and literally a written description of what you want to achieve. Whilst others, it's like, I need visual references of what you're talking about. They have more visual brains. And of course, like children will especially be the same. But when we're talking, like you say, about much younger children where, you know, speaking might not exactly be on the table at that stage, you know, they're kind of below five and they're still going through the same processes of change. Actually being creative could be a really good idea. And like you say, with drawings and things like that.
But it's even little ones. I mean, if you're thinking about non-verbal children, we can still be having emotional conversations. A child who's under one, who's crying, and you don't know why as the parent or the caregiver, there's the same message of, oh gosh, you're really upset. I'm so sorry, mummy or daddy's here or whoever you are. And naming, you seem really upset. Actually, that's beginning. We go back to the upstairs, downstairs brain. That begins with nonverbal children where you're containing, you're either physically holding or emotionally holding whatever they're going through and saying, it's okay and I'm here to go through it with you. So actually that goes right back to newborn, that we can stretch out. It's a very different type of conversation because you're not going to get the feedback from a one-year-old than you might for a 5 or 6-year-old, but the principles remain the same.
Yeah, of course. And actually it's no more or less real, that emotion, just because they're younger, they're still going to need the same sort of emotional prop from the parent as they would at 5 or 15 or even 25, you know, it kind of carries on through, doesn't it? I mean, with those kind of tips and things, are there any kind of, again, we can pop this in the show notes and stuff, but any kind of useful links for parents that might be sitting there going, okay, I'll be creative. Oh God, like what can I do? You know, like what are those ideas? You know, is there anywhere that you could point them towards?
Yeah, I'm very happy to send through some things. I mean, I'm a big fan of books and the theory of osmosis, that if I buy a book, I'll absorb the information. So I'm conscious of sharing too many books with the listeners today. But I think there's some great resources out there. I can definitely send some signposting stuff. But I think it's, again, you know your child best. You know the person you're looking after best, no matter how old they are. And I think be creative. One of the things that I think it's really biased, and I think this is personal, so I wouldn't say this is for everybody, but you know, something like the concept of a worry box. Get an old tissue box, turn it into a post box, and let young people post a worry or a concern in that box, and you can review it with your child at an agreed period. Or having a chart at home that helps you flag up color code, number code. But thinking about those kind of things, I think, how would you translate that into your household, your culture, your family? That's different for everybody. I'm not here as a man to say, come and do what I do.
Yeah.
You know, that's different for everybody, and it's got to be specific to loads of different things.
Well, like we're saying, like I still see it with on a day-to-day basis with colleagues, you know, like the differences of how they like to be, you know, receive information and how they actually digest it as well. So it's always kind of really, really interesting. Not going to name names, but no, it's actually, but no, but it's funny because you ultimately still trying to get the same result. You just have to kind of read the room. And if it's a 2-year-old, then that's the room you need to read. I mean, for this is, I know the answer almost for this, but is there a kind of point where maybe a parent's listening to this and going, like, when do I seek professional advice? When, what's that point? You know, when it, no matter what age child, like, you know, maybe behavior is escalating or they've just started to see signs. Is there a perfect time to reach out and ask for help?
I don't think I don't think there is, which are probably not the most helpful answer. It's not like a here's the tipping point that you need to make contact with a professional. I guess my stance, both personally and professionally with that, is if you as a parent are finding things difficult, that's the point to get help. Don't wait till it gets really difficult, because the more embedded the difficulty is, the more untangling that will require from the system and potentially professionals. So I think, you know, sometimes it's about, I'm not a big fan of the phrase, but can you nip it in the bud? Can you address difficulties earlier so that they're not quite so embedded? And again, go back to the brain. The more something becomes a pattern, the stronger it becomes in the brain as a pathway. So if we can start to think, oh, little Johnny has really started wetting the bed recently. It's happened for the last week. And that's a problem because you just don't know what to do. Then that might be a point to seek help. You might also get to the end of the week thinking, yeah, but I've got a pretty good idea of what to do about this. So I'll try that out for this period of time, or I'm going to read that book that someone recommended. And if that doesn't work, then I'll do it. That's the uniqueness of each household. I don't think there's an exact point, but I think it relates to what we said earlier. How are you as a parent or caregiver? And if you're finding it really challenging with your little one, if it was a bump on their arm, you'd rush them to doc. If it's about their psychological well-being, why wouldn't you seek that support? Whether that's via your GP or whether that's through a local charity, in more clinical examples, whether that's your local child and adolescent mental health service or private practitioner, whatever that looks like, we've got to have quality across physical and mental health here, and I really can't hold a strong enough position on that.
No, exactly. Especially as you highlight that, you know, before the behaviour beds in, you know, like, and that becomes the process. And I think, again, kind of going back to what you said earlier, you know, there's going to be nuances. It's like, well, actually, this week he is bedwetting, but it's like he's just gone back to school, or he's just started nursery, or there's, you know, there's something that's dramatic that's happened. okay, let's see, like give it another week just while things calm down. Or if those things haven't changed and it's just out of the blue, like you know yourself, you know your family, you know your environment, so you'll be able to pick up on those kind of differences. And that's really interesting. And I suppose as well, like kind of going back, because again, you know, this came from a conversation we had prior to the recording. You know, your children's environment is kind of sort of built by the parents in a certain respect, isn't it? You know, of how stressed the parent is or happy or sad or whatever. If a parent is kind of struggling, you know, themselves, because actually, I mean, we've got a fact here from the NSPCC, and it says from the first to the third week of lockdown, the number of adults that contacted the NSPCC helpline about parental mental health increased by just over a quarter. So it's like 28%. So obviously the uncertainty at that really early stages of coronavirus increased, you know, obviously pressure and anxiety for parents, especially with, I'm sure there's a lot of partners out there that have had to see, you know, loved ones, wives, partners go through childbirth on their own, which must have been an absolute crazy time for a lot of, you know, new parents or, you know, existing families. I mean, what sort of, I suppose it kind of goes back again, I suppose, because you know yourself, but what advice would you give to a parent who might be nervous about seeking support? You know, they've really tried to get through everything and they're, you know, they're, I don't know, probably like we were saying with these bedding in behaviours from children, you know, they don't think that, you know, seeking help is almost like a sign of weakness or anything like that. You know, what if they're feeling those anxieties, what kind of advice would you give them to kind of help break out of that cycle?
I think you flagged something really important there, that we all have different relationships with professionals and seeking help. And I think the first part is just owning it. If you're the type of person that's reluctant to do it, then own that and think about what other resources there are, if it's not a professional, or how else you can learn and understand or seek information. At the risk of repeating myself, I think it's so important to go back to the point that parents and caregivers have to be okay for their young people to be okay. And in the context of the current situation with COVID, it's normal reactions to abnormal events. We would expect parents to find things more challenging right now than they did 2 years ago. Obviously, their circumstances might have changed with the number of children and what have you, but it's not, you know, giving birth during the pandemic or raising children in the pandemic is not the same as it was 2 years ago, nor will it be in 2 years' time. And so I think we have to look at normalizing some of those responses without jumping straight to conclusions about how somebody is. And it's also about coping and functioning. If it's so overwhelming that it's stopping you from coping and functioning, then what help do you need? So I think the first thing for me is thinking with parents, what's in your locus of control? What can you influence? So I would love nothing more than to be the person that came up with the cure for COVID and it was no longer, and we could all just return back to doing all the normal things that we used to do. That's not something in my control. I certainly don't have the skill set for that. I don't think I ever would. I don't know if anybody ever will. But I might be able to control my response to how little Johnny is when he screams at 3 a.m. And that is in my control in terms of my own emotional response when I'm triggered by something. So it's thinking about what's within your control and then trying to work out how to problem solve, whether that's with a professional or by yourself or with some self-help books. But it's thinking about what you can influence yourself. Similarly, you know, lots of families have had members on furlough, and that is potentially something out of their control. Their financial situation might now be out of their control, which we would predict, again, would have an impact on their emotional well-being. So it's then about, well, what can you do to influence your emotional well-being? So there's been loads of stuff published during COVID about doing the best you can in the current circumstances. So, you know, going stereotypical stuff, people are talking about taking a commute to work. You know, you're working in the front room. Actually, can you walk around the block as if you were walking to the tube station or to the bus stop, so that there's a separation between finishing one task and starting work? You know, what's the marker of the end of the day that might have been the commute home? How can you replicate? How do you get fresh air? How do you do socializing? How do you mirror the normal, in inverted commas, things that you're doing that might do the best in a mad set of circumstances? And also, where's your social support? You know, we've all been isolated. We're all in our relevant houses working from home, other than some key workers. Parents haven't had necessarily the social supports and the support protective factors that they had before. So kids going back to school is a huge resource to parents in terms of what amazing teachers and social situations that provides for kids. How do we implement that? You know, we're just opening up. Are there sports clubs? Are there youth clubs? And what is it that's going to support parents to have that respite that actually also helps the young person thrive? We know that's helpful, whether that's a little one going to a baby group or a teenager going to a youth club, whatever that looks like. That's also in the parent's best interest and the young person.
It's actually very interesting. I kind of was putting myself in that answer. And I used to joke about, I'm not working from home, I'm living at work, right? And, you know, very funny, like, yeah, very witty. But actually, in hindsight, such a wonderful thing. It was actually kind of a period where it's exactly what you're saying. I wasn't differentiating my workday from my home life. And like, you know, because, you know, your dining room's your office, but your dining room's also becoming the place where you eat or where you want to spend your evenings and all this kind of stuff. And it takes time, but over a period of time, it does sort of affect you in different ways. So actually it's funny you said about almost like mimicking your walk commute. You know, back in the day I used to walk 40 minutes to work every day and 40 minutes home, so I used to do that in the mornings. And like the immediate difference that made, it was like, it was almost kind of like instant. And it was actually, and I did it at the end of the day, and it was a really nice way to bookend. Like, that was my working period now. Because also, like, God love my husband, I was talking to him as if I was his manager. And he was like, yay, this Naomi. But it would actually take me, if I didn't actually put in a marker of difference in the day, it would then take me like an hour to kind of shake off that response to him, which must have been dreamy for him for the last year. But I can imagine, you know, yeah, it's actually, they're such small, they might seem like that's not going to work, but actually it really can make such a difference. And, you know, as you said, kids going back to school and stuff like that, actually, yeah, after school clubs, things like, you know, just give yourself that maybe an extra hour for you just to kind of step back. And you know, like you say, it's great for the kids, they thrive with that stuff, but also it's good that they can really throw themselves and kind of start really playing with mates and getting back to that kind of that normal sense.
I think it's also really important though that we have and will continue to repeat bad patterns. So I don't sit here saying, yeah, I commute to work every day. My wife would have a field day with me if she heard me say that on this podcast. But it's the point that, can we catch it? Oh gosh, I haven't had any fresh air for 2 days. Probably need to do something about that. And I would imagine that resonates with a lot of people listening. So it's not about, oh no, I didn't do it, what am I doing? It's rather, going back to the point I was saying before around, what can I control? Actually, I can problem solve that. I can make myself get fresh air every day. Rather than I didn't, it's saying, what do I need to do different? And think of what you can control in the situation.
And actually just even putting it as a positive, you know, a conversation with yourself, it again sort of, you know, yeah, drives out a little bit more kind of optimism in yourself. Like, I'm fixing this. This is something I can control.
I wanted to add before about when I was talking about going to like extra resources, after school clubs, social clubs. I think that's very circumstantial. I think we need to own that as well. That's resource based. That's going to vary family by family, but it's also what is, in inverted commas, normal. You know, school was supposed to be a normal thing, or, you know, people who are part of a religious community going to that religious community would be a normal part of their routine. So it's not necessarily having to do extra resources or introduce extra things into the family timetable. It's kind of, how do you get back to what was normal beforehand that was protective and helping your child thrive, whether it was playing with a cousin in the park or whatever that might be. I don't suddenly want listeners to think, right, I've got to fill the schedule and get loads and loads in, rather fitting in with what they were already doing.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like, right, that's it. I'm booking in Johnny's tap dancing lessons, you know, all this kind of like swimming class and all this kind of thing. If they hadn't done that before, yeah, in a way, don't necessarily, because that actually makes it feel even more extraordinary than ordinary for that kid, because they'd be like, why am I doing all this stuff? You know, kind of thing. Because actually, if they want to come home and have an hour of screen time, lovely. Like, that's, if that's fine, then that's fine. Because I have to, yeah, because I suppose as for kids as much as adults, we're not necessarily creatures that adapt to change dreadfully well. So obviously, you know, even from those NSPCC stats that we started off life, you know, obviously we dramatically had that effect from adults to children in the first kind of few weeks of lockdown. Likewise, I think, like you say, it's an extraordinary time. Don't beat yourself up. Even with over the next few weeks and coming months, as things ease, it's the same, you know, as as going in, as coming out, because we have been able to kind of put up defences and skills to kind of cope with the last year. Hopefully that will give a lot of parents a bit of comfort as well that, yeah, you know, it's the behaviours and things that might be happening now don't have the potential really of being permanent. It's environment based, and hopefully things will settle down.
And I think that's also about transitions, isn't it? I agree with you. We are creatures of habit. Change is hard and it's variable for every individual, of course. But, you know, thinking about the kids, young people going back to school in March, you know, the proportion of young people suddenly presenting with school anxieties or school refusal was incomparable to what we've seen before. And we're thinking, okay, well, we need to talk more about phased return, whether that's school, work, social life, shopping, whatever the listener's thing is, or whatever works for their family. It's kind of thinking, the first time you went to a supermarket and you were allowed, it was probably a bit like, whoa, there's people. And actually, it's allowing yourself to have that emotional response, because you've been cooped up inside for a very long time. That's not, in inverted commas, normal. And so actually that transitional phase of allowing yourself to slowly do things. Obviously, there are some compulsory things like going to school or like following your employer's guidance in terms of where you need to work, which will be variable for listeners if they're working. But the principle of phased returns, you know, you don't have to go from 0 to 100 with all things that you're doing, and allowing yourself that transition, because in a very long time in a very strange set of circumstances, and that psychologists will call that a graded exposure. How do we slowly open ourselves up to something that might feel a bit uncomfortable rather than flooding, which is jumping in at the deep end and suddenly being able to swim?
I think that actually gives me a bit of comfort as well, the fact that psychologists have a term for it. Like, it's not no, but you know what I mean, it's actually like a recognized thing of, like, you know, don't think you're failing fantastically because you can't just immediately switch back on. And likewise for children to adults, actually this is a recognized thing. You need to kind of lower yourself into it and just give yourself that bit of breathing time.
Yeah, I mean, if you and I were having a conversation about a child or an adult, for that matter, who is scared of spiders, we wouldn't suddenly get them to hold a tarantula. You know, we'd do that graded exposure. We would do that, but, well, let's just talk about spiders. That's probably really quite uncomfortable. Okay, let's look at a photo of a spider. Let's look at a photo of a spider for longer. Let's watch a video of a spider. And we'd slowly give them and experience more and more of being around the spider, talking about spiders, until eventually it's probably not ever going to get to, I feel great holding this spider, but it isn't debilitating. They're able to do it. And actually, the theory remains the same. We've all been indoors. We've all lived in strange circumstances. So how do we do that slow exposure back to, in inverted commas, again, normality?
Yeah. That's so funny, because I do know so many people are like, oh, you know what you need to do, like grab the spider. I think, yeah, certain people will behave very differently. But I think, yeah, the more graduated approach is probably more applicable to more people, you know, and to understand that.
I think, again, it's individual based, right? So you might be the type of person that wants to jump in the deep end, give me that spider. I just want to hold it. That will get me over my fear.
Yeah.
And the next person I speak to will be like, whoa, 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 let's slow that right down.
There's a spider in this room? Yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah, yeah.
And that's about moving at the pace of the individual. Because if you're not someone that wants to jump in the deep end, then I say we're jumping, you're going to walk out the room. No problem. Whereas, so that's, again, it's like for the listeners, it's not we go with flooding or we go with graded exposure. It's saying, listen to yourself, know your child, what's going to work best for them.
Yeah, fantastic. And I think, yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, for, you know, we're getting to the Sadly, we're nearly at the end of this podcast and I could actually carry on. We actually did have a pre-conversation about this of going, how are we going to cap ourselves with this? I feel like, Dr. Ben, you may be a regular, because like you say, it's such a huge subject and it is so personalized and individualized in the best sort of practices and the way anybody can kind of, you know, start to understand themselves or feelings and behaviors in others, especially children. So hopefully we'll be able to kind of, you know, get a lot of that support, like you said, with some links and some, you know, some resources straight away for parents to kind of really look through and see kind of what they can gain and garner from those. But I mean, for any kind of like last sort of parting words for, you know, someone that might have see signs with anxiety with maybe a child that's just, you know, a starting nursery or kind of just about to. Is there any kind of like small sort of takeaways that you would possibly leave them with, even just advice?
I think the first thing is, well, let me start that again. I think the key bit is about the idea of containment. The role of a parent and a caregiver is to help the young person feel, I'm going to be okay. So that idea of going to nursery is utterly terrifying. And actually it's the adult's job not to say, I'm going to make it better, rather than I'm here. We've got this, and being that united front. So depending on the child, that might be a hug, that might be a distraction. That could be a lot of different things. And again, the listeners are going to know their children best. I think the other key bit is also, depending on the child, is naming things, having that communication, having that normality of we can talk about feelings around each other. For me, I think if there's one thing I do with most families I meet, it's talking about the concept of special time, which is making, you know, a lot of the textbooks will say 10 minutes per child per day of one-to-one time. I'm a pragmatist. I think I work with lots of different people. So I would often say, what's going to work with you in your life? But how do you enter the child's world for a set period of time every day, whether that's feeding the fish, whether that's bath time, whether that's reading a book, whatever, whether that's playing Lego, whatever that looks like. How do you go child-led into their world uninterrupted for a set period of time every day? Because that builds the foundation then for a young person to be able to talk, to be able to do the things, because they've got that problem-free time. So I think aside from COVID, that's something that I talk about most days at work. I think it's about normalizing. I think the other key bit is about normalizing it. You know, if you've got a very young child going to nursery, not normalize it because they might not have the same level of language. And I think the key bit is for parents to have somewhere to say, oh my God, my child is having a nightmare setting in, and to own their own feelings, because that's going to have a secondary effect. The child's level of distress at getting to the nursery door is going to impact the parent or a caregiver. So where are they taking that? Where's their support? Because it goes back to what we were saying before about how do you make sure you're okay so that your child's. So having those support networks around you in whatever circumstances we're allowed to do that at the moment, I think is absolutely.
That's brilliant. There's some really nice kind of, you could do that this evening kind of thing, kind of advice for people that it's accessible as well. And it does make me smile. So when you said about the sort of 10 minutes per child, it's like, that's very formulaic. But like you say, it doesn't have to be, it could be an hour. Like you say, it could be bath time, however long that takes. Or like you say, just 5 minutes in between meetings. I think that's a really interesting kind of dedicated time and space to start with your child.
Brilliant. And I think that's about what works for you as a family.
Yeah.
The pragmatist in me kicks in thinking, as long as you're totally present, it's the quality, not the quantity.
No, I completely agree. Completely agree. That's fantastic. Oh, brilliant. Well, Ben, thank you so much for coming on our season finale of
iCat. Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And I'm sure we'll probably get quite a lot of questions come through from our listeners, which we'll probably bombard you with and expect and demand that you come back. But yeah, it would be really interesting actually to hear from our listeners on today's podcast, and just any sort of, you know, any kind of comments or anything that you've kind of really kind of gained from today's podcast. Brilliant.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us on the first season of the Eye Candy Duo podcast and for all the growing support over the past 17 episodes. We will be back with even more celeb interviews and expert special episodes very soon. So be sure to hit subscribe and follow us on the Eye Candy World social channels to make sure you don't miss the start of season two. Eye Candy is a proud supporter of Great Ormond Street Children's Hospital charity. COVID-19 means the hospital is facing new challenges and needs more support than ever to continue the life-changing care and research for seriously ill children. If you are able to support GOSH, please head to our dedicated fundraising page on www.justgiving.com/company/eyecandy.